Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Good morning, everyone. So the premise we're examining is, does income inequality, that is a concentration of wealth by the very few,
right,
produce economic instability? Whether we're talking about the states or nations or whether we're talking about the financial meltdown, Ray Brescia, who was with us, you still with us, Ray?
Yes.
He wrote this study earlier this month called The Cost of Inequality, Social Distance, Predatory Conduct, and the Financial Crisis, which looks at this instability-inequality equation on a state-by-state basis. But really, the whole issue was raised last week on the program when Louise Story came in, our financial contributor and Wall Street and finance reporter for our part in the New York Times. Good morning, Louise.
Good morning.
When you came in and talked about this disturbing correlation between the income gap between the rich and poor in 1928 and in 2007, and how strongly correlated the concentration of wealth among the few seems to be with a notion of economic instability leading to a financial meltdown. You got a lot of response from this story.
I did get a lot of response, and in fact, one of them was from Ray, who sent me his study on the states. One of the biggest challenges that economists like Ray have, though, is proving that there is this relationship. Because, you know, crisis in 1929, crisis in 2007, that's not many data points.
Well, there's an intuitive sort of course, and we got some response along the same lines. Hugh Appett on our Facebook page says, well, duh, aside from what they said, there's also the fact that when the upper 10% get more than half of everything, the rest have to divide the leftovers. That's one intuitive notion. Here's what James David Cowart said on our Facebook page. It could lead to job growth if the rich can hire the poor without having overwhelming government regulation. That's the trickle-down theory, that the rich invest in the poor and it makes jobs for everyone. First of all, Louise, what is the suspected sort of agent that would cause the instability to produce a financial meltdown insofar as you and your sources have been able to find?
Well, there are a few different theories. One is that this big gap in wealth makes people at the bottom, people who are poorer, do things that put the system at risk, for instance, take on too much debt because they don't have enough money to live. But the other theories, which I found interesting, and this is kind of a new line of research in economic inequality, is to look at the top, because they used to only look at the bottom. And when you look at the top, you've got some economists out there saying maybe when the wealth is so great for the few, there's more incentive to do financial crime or just to do things that are really stinky in the way you run your business and finance. Or maybe when there's so much wealth at the top, it pushes those people at the top to push for policies that promote bubbles and leverage because that brings more wealth to people at the top.
Well, let's talk to Ray about this. So, Ray Brescia, what you have found, echoing exactly what Louise is saying here, is that financial delinquencies, defaults, actually follows the income train upward, not downward?
Well, I think that we've got the national trend, right? We can look at the graphs. We can say that you've got concentrated wealth in the top 10%. We can look at inequality. We see it spike before the Depression. We see it drop. We see it rise again in the 2000s. But we don't see that's not a national tsunami, right? We don't have each state affected by that national trend in the same way. And so that's what led me to look at, well, can we explain what's going on in different states based on the income inequality within each state, which is a figure the Census Bureau actually generates. And we do see a correlation at the state level, which sort of I think it gives strength to the argument that we have to look at this income inequality if it's having this impact at the state level. And I think my theory is, and a couple of other data points sort of support this, that when you've got this income inequality, you have what is known as greater social distance, that people see a greater distance between them and others. And when you have this greater social distance, you are more likely to take advantage of other people, and you'll have more predatory conduct. And I think that when you see correlations between income inequality and crime rates, when you see correlations between income inequality and diminishing trust in a state, then you also see correlations between income inequality and foreclosures.
And the distance works both.
Things come together.
And the distance works both ways. The people at the top feel more predatory. The people at the bottom feel more predatory. They don't have a stake in each other's well-being. Is that kind of what you're saying?
I think that it's fair to say that you could have income inequality affecting people on the top and the bottom in the same way. You know, who is more dangerous in the financial area,
the
I think is a question.
Era. But, Luis, let me ask you, one of the original proponents of this theory, Raghu Rajan, said that really at the heart of this is the government play in this, because he said what ends up happening when a government isn't able to address really the underlying problems of middle-income and low-income Americans is they instead offer easy credit. This is like their placebo pill to make people feel better about their financial situation, and that's what's caused the problem.
That's right. They're particularly conservative economists say, no, the financial crisis was caused by politicians trying to respond to economic inequality by giving cheap credit to people at the bottom. But, you know, others would say, well, wait a minute. It's not really income redistribution to give people cheaper credit. How about educating them, or how about redistributing income, not debt? And so I'm not sure that explains it all. You know, the other thing, one thing that's interesting about Ray is he has 50 different data points to states. But another thing that people are starting to look at is economic financial crises around the world. So there's another economist I spoke to, Richard Freeman at Harvard, who's looking at 125 crises around the world over the last 30 years. And he's just in his initial studies, but he says in many, many of them, he can already see economic inequality spikes. Then comes a financial crisis.
Ray Brescia, what's the most surprising data point that strikes out to you from your state-by-state analysis?
Well, there are a number of them, but if just to respond to that last point, I think the argument that we used easy credit to help low-income people just doesn't hold water when you look at this same set of data and say, okay, was there any connection between foreclosure rates and poverty rates? And there's none. There's no connection between a state's poverty rate and its foreclosure rate. What this problem is, this financial crisis at the foreclosure level, is a problem of the middle class.
And when you say problem of the middle class, it is investors preying on the middle class, luring them into investments that go sour.
That's right. That's right. That you've got middle class borrowers who should have received prime loans and not subprime loans, and data, you know, some research shows as many as 60% of subprime borrowers could have qualified for prime loans. We've got middle class borrowers being led into loans that turn toxic
by the millions. Ray Brescia, assistant professor of law at Albany Law School, and Louise Story, Wall Street and Finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Interesting stuff.